The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Again, just a warm welcome. It's a nice thing to practice together. And today I wanted to continue. I've been doing some series on the seven factors of awakening. And I'll just briefly say these are qualities that can support the awakening or finding greater and greater freedom. And some of the qualities that are in this list, right? There's so many lists, right? So some of these things that are in this list are in other lists too, but I'm trying to highlight some of the things that are a little bit different than the usual way we think about some of these things. So the first is mindfulness. The second is investigation. And tonight I'd like to talk about the third one, which in Pali is this word virya, which in English is kind of really is has the same root as this word virile. So in Pali it's associated with being the hero. So somebody who has this real strength or this warrior or this ability to have this tremendous exertion to make these extraordinary accomplishments, right? Sometimes when we think about warrior, we think about that. And certainly there are traditions in Buddhism that emphasizes this sense of being a warrior, but that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. Instead, in Buddhism, there's also this word virya also kind of moves into this word of effort, just that we can't be completely passive and expect our life to unfold differently. But also there's a version or an interpretation or a slice of this word virya that points to courage. And that's something I'd like to talk about tonight, this idea of courage. And again, not so much that we need it for the big, giant things in our lives, but of course we do. But also, what are all the small ways, the everyday ways, in which courage supports our having our best possible life for us to have more and more freedom? So one way we could understand courage is this capacity to face fear, to just be able to not run away or collapse or shut down or somehow just stop being with when fear arises. It allows us to, sometimes we use this word fear, but maybe we'll use this word humiliation, or this, you know, this idea that there might be humiliation, public speaking, for example, or just this idea of danger. Maybe it's not, we don't have this word, I have to face fear. It's just this idea that there's danger here, whether it's physical harm or some other kind of harm. And I'd like to explore that a little bit more, because as long as human beings have this idea that there's something to lose, and sometimes this idea of what we have to lose is this sense of self. I'm a person who doesn't look like a fool. I'm a person who doesn't make giant mistakes. I'm a person who doesn't trip. Whatever it might be, right? We have so many ideas about how we want to be viewed, these ideas about ourselves. And as long as we have those, in addition to all the ways in which there might be physical danger or harm or threat, as long as we have some holding on to an idea about ourselves, then we have some risk. And then we might need some courage to do things that stretch our ideas about ourselves, or that this idea that uncertainty and risk, of course we have this as part of our lives, so we might need a little bit of courage. So fear is definitely part of the human experience. There's no way around it. And so we would say it's not so much the absence of fear that is like this human ideal. It's more, how do we work with it? How do we live our lives, even though there is uncertainty, risk, fear? How do we show up in the world? How do we allow it not to make our world get smaller and smaller and smaller? So, kind of in the Buddhist tradition, the stereotypical example of courage is this story, this dramatic, big story of when the Buddha is sitting down on the eve of his awakening. And the story is that the tradition holds that Mara did not want the person who was to become the Buddha to become awakened. So Mara brings his army, and there's different versions of this story. Sometimes they're filled with different types of demons, and sometimes it's more rocks and tornadoes and whatever it was. The Buddha had made a resolve that he was going to become awakened, so despite all these frightening things and beings coming towards him, he didn't budge. He stayed, had some courage, and became awakened. And in my view, part of the reason why this has, you know, stayed through the ages as a story for Buddhism is because it is dramatic. There's a lot of gory details and the way that Mara was coming towards the Buddha, but chances are, in our daily lives, we don't have that experience of demons or, well, hopefully we don't have tornadoes or, you know, all the weather chasing after us or something like this. But so part of courage is to be fearful in proportion to the actual danger. Sometimes it's, and I know I've done this plenty of times in my life, where something that felt a little bit frightening or I wasn't unsure about, I just blew up into out of proportion and got completely panicky and really fearful about. And so part of courage is being able to just recognize, okay, what are the real threats? And what are going to have some real dire consequences? So part of courage is to maybe to look at fear and to interact with it and to maybe put it a little bit into perspective. That's not always available. Sometimes when there's a little bit of fear, we might freeze. We might not have our best wisdom available to us. But that's something to think about. It's not that the fear has to go away, but is there a way that we can keep it manageable so that we can have the capacity to move forward, not be frozen, so that we can confront what it is that the suffering, the struggle, whatever it might be. And maybe confront is not the right word. Maybe just face, acknowledge some of the difficulties. So despite that we might be in the midst of them. So part of the courage that is needed in this practice that is not these big giant stories or something that we're going to write a lot of our own stories about or write home about. Maybe we will. But some of it is like implicit in some of these foundational teachings. The first noble truth. There is suffering. And sometimes it takes courage just to recognize the suffering. Not only our own, but the suffering of others. There's no shortage of this, of course, right? We know about the oppression and the hatred and the racism and the inequalities that are happening. And sometimes it takes a little courage to acknowledge that. If we're not experiencing it at that moment, and so many of us are at that moment, and it's not even a choice to not be seeing all of it, but there's so much. So to acknowledge the suffering of others and then to not acknowledge our own suffering. Some of it's obvious and some of it is really subtle. So part of the Buddhist practice is to be with the suffering, to acknowledge it, to be mindful of it, allow it to be there. And sometimes this takes courage. Because it's a habit to not be with difficulties. Of course it's a habit. And of course it takes some training to be with uncomfortableness. And to recognize even some of those little quiet difficulties that we have. I'll talk about those in a little bit here in a moment, but I kind of like this idea of thinking about the First Noble Truth, just recognizing the suffering is also that maybe the Buddha felt like he had to make it a noble truth, this recognition that we don't like to be with suffering, and it takes a little bit of courage to recognize and to be with and to acknowledge and to allow in a way in which we're not shutting down around it. Because there is this way in which there might be this kind of quiet, maybe, but pervasive fear in our lives, in our everyday lives. As I mentioned, humans, we are all vulnerable. We have bodies. They can get sick and be injured, and they do age, and they will die. And of course we don't like to think about this, and when we are reminded of this with injuries or accidents or illnesses or either our own or those of our loved ones, then often there's a like, oh yeah, this is having a body makes us vulnerable, and we don't like to be vulnerable. So no matter how confident we are, no matter how brave we are, or no matter how many advantages we might have or not have, we are all vulnerable. And there's a way in which there might be this quiet little way in which we don't readily acknowledge, but it's a little bit persistent. I better take my vitamins so that I don't get sick. I better put sunscreen on for those of us who have fair skin so I don't get injured just by simply being outside. I need to do those exercises that physical therapist gave me years ago to take care of these body parts. So this risk is just an essential component of life. And to be sure, right, if we were not open to the uncontrollable elements of life, if we didn't have any fear or a little bit of worry, then we wouldn't be human. That's what it means to be a divine, to be a god. Is to not have anything uncontrollable, not to have anything that causes us to be vulnerable. So some people perceive this world as really harmful, and that's their real orientation, and they focus on that. And they tend to like pull back from life. And I recently was feeling some fear about something, and I just thought I wanted to, was there a way that I could work with this? And I thought I would just make a list of the things that I'm afraid of. It started with, you know, the big giant obvious things, and then also giant, maybe I'll just say the obvious things. I'm not so keen on bugs that are in my living space. And I'm afraid of some of the stuff I see happening in the news. But it ended up being kind of a long list as I started to poke around on all the things I felt a little bit vulnerable around. And I was really delighted to see that there's this poem. Sometimes I think poets can say things in such a nice way. At least I find this. This fantastic poem by Rosemary Traumer. I just love her as a poet. She's just, I think, an amazing poet. And this poem is called Mus Musculus. And that's the Latin name for mouse. And the poem goes like this. Today, fear is a mouse that scuttles between thoughts and feeds on whatever it finds, nibbles on my certainties, gnaws the coating off my circuitries, and pulls the stuffing out of each moment. Those are its droppings in the hallways of my mind. I thought it was worse when fear was a tiger, a badger, a wolverine, but the mouse of fear finds its way into everything. Makes nests inside my minutes, discovers passages into my inner walls, then scratches against them at night. It never goes near the traps I've set. No, it scampers around them. Its soft feet pattering, its small dark eyes noting everywhere I go. There's this way, right? Kind of like merging the cuteness of a little mouse, or sometimes we're afraid of mice. I'm not, myself, I'm not so afraid of mice. I find them a little bit cute, but I say that having never lived in a place that has a lot of mice. So, but we, there's a way in which we say this word courage. We might think we need it for the big, giant things. But Rosemary Traumer, she's pointing to the way that it kind of like gets into our so many little things of our experiences. So whereas we might think, oh, we need courage for these difficult conversations or changing our living situation in some kind of way, we might just need it for the ordinary things of this life. And especially if we tend to view the world as an unsafe place. And some of us do. We have this orientation where we just naturally think that the world is unsafe. Not everybody has that view. But this perpetually feeling fear has an effect on us. So there's a way in which we kind of come habituated to it. Like, oh, I'm afraid of this and this and this. And there's a way in which there's this fear, might be our kind of increasing inability to take risks, or our inability to be innovative, or to feel deeply, or to think autonomously. So these fears can chip away at our freedom, can chip away at our living our best life, can render us a little bit more passive in our lives. And it also can show up in the kind of like the spiritual realm in this way that we might think it's very spiritual, but it isn't so helpful. And that is a sense of humility, of not speaking up or not saying, well, I could use IMC, maybe not volunteering or not doing whatever it is, sharing the Dharma or coming to classes. I certainly had a lot of fear. Dharma practice days, wow, that was really hard for me. It wasn't until a friend said, come to these Dharma practice days, for those of you who don't know. We haven't done them for the past few years, but Gil used to do these. And there'd be some teachings, guided meditations, and there'd be these small groups where we'd get in small groups and discuss things. The Zoom equivalent is a breakout room. And it wasn't until a friend said, you should come, these are really great, Diana. I said, no, I don't think so. And my friend said, well, I'll be in each group with you. And I'm like, okay. And as I come to find out, I met so many great, beautiful people and really found a deepening of the Dharma by being able to talk to other people and share ideas and hear other people. It was really, really a big support for me. So there might be this way in which there's this contrived humility, which we don't speak up or we don't do things, whether it's in these small breakout rooms when we're on Zoom or if you're in person to come here. And we're using the word humility, but maybe it's just fear. That's okay. But just a little query for ourselves. You know, what is it that allows me to be quiet? And I don't say that you don't have to be quiet. Some people are just quiet. That's perfectly fine. Some people are introverts, some are extroverts. But just to ask the question, what is it that's supporting my quietness? So maybe that we can talk a little bit about what about developing courage for some of these everyday things in which fear shows up. This is an interesting thing that in the Buddhist teachings, there isn't a specific teaching, like how to have courage or how to have more energy. Like even if we want to look at this word virya even more broadly, there isn't anything about how to have more. But we can look at a few things here that can help us. This idea, if we feel like we want to kind of meet life with a little bit more energy, with a little bit more courage. And one is that this isn't specifically in the Buddhist texts, but there is a connection, kind of maybe common sense tells us, there's a connection between courage and trust. We can say, right, you only have fear if you don't have trust, or there's a relationship there. So there's a way in which trust is also, sometimes we trust ourselves, but sometimes we trust something other than ourselves. So is there a way that we might shift, instead of being so concerned about ourselves, to maybe tune into something that's bigger than ourselves? And there can be something completely neutral about the environment, feeling our feet on the ground, for example, feeling grounded, connected. Yes, I am here. But there's also a way in which we could expand, kind of like the in this tradition, a way trust. Maybe for some people it's meaningful to take homage in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That doesn't resonate with everybody, and that's perfectly fine. But for some people it does. Some of you know there's a chant that we do at the beginning of retreats often. We don't do it so commonly here at the meditation center, but just this idea of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, like, that's going to be my orientation. This is going to be something that's going to support me. So it can be literally chanting. I won't chant it now, but for those of you who do know, it's a very short chant. Taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Maybe it's something else that's chanting that can take us out of the immediate fear. For me, there was a big time in my meditation practice. This was quite some time ago when I had a lot of fear. I don't even know why. But a teacher gave a recommendation to me that turned out to be really helpful. And this was when I sat down to meditate, just to begin with chanting the Metta Sutta silently in my mind. And this was really helpful. Or sometimes if I found myself slipping into a little bit of panicky or fear, if I could, just to bring the Metta Sutta to mind. It wasn't until later that I learned that this is a normal part of practice. It's not uncommon, if you've been practicing for a while, that you'll kind of like slip into some fear. And maybe it's just some fear from your life, but it might also just be this is a season of practice. It's part of how practice works, is that these different, I like this word, seasons arise, and we work through them. So this is one way for courage, is to notice this connection between trust and courage, and maybe specifically there can be some connection with the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, with the Metta chant. And I know later Buddhists in Mahayana, they have a lot of devotional practices. For some people, it's really meaningful, lighting candles, chanting, doing a little bit of ritual. These types of things can be helpful because they touch a part of us that isn't necessarily the thinking mind. Because often when we're having fear, it's not always the most rational part of ourselves. There might be a part that's not rational that needs some support. So that's one thing, is to do something devotional, chanting, ritual, whatever is helpful for you. Doesn't work for everybody, but whatever is helpful for you. And then I appreciate that Brené Brown, she's this very well-known, I think she's a psychologist or sociologist, and she has this book that's called The Gifts of Imperfection. And she writes, courage is a habit, a virtue. You get it by doing courageous acts. It's like you learn to swim by swimming. You learn to courage by couraging. So, couraging. You might think about, well, what does that mean? And in some ways, we might think that this is so much what we do with our meditation practice. Like, we think that we might have started the meditation practice to have some new insights, some wisdom, to maybe make our life easier in some way. Maybe we think we might have some cool meditative experiences, but often we don't think that meditation practice is practicing with courage. But in fact, in many ways it is. It's often not until meditation practice, when our minds and our hearts quiet, that we have to face things about ourselves that we haven't seen before. Or maybe we have to face things again that we thought we might have worked through and understood, okay, I'm over that, but then it shows up again. And it takes some courage to not just completely shut down, but to just stay with, yep, here's that anger again. Here's that sadness again. And to just be with it. Allow it to be there. So there's this way in which meditation practice, just the courage to start over again with the breath, if we've been lost in thought for so many times, the courage to meet that difficult emotion again and again. This is how we become courageous are these small little repeated acts of meeting difficulties over and over again. And in this way, it's part of a factor of awakening. These small little acts of courage, they do add up, and they help us to show up for our life differently and allows our life to unfold differently in a way in which there might be some more ease, some more freedom. And that can help support finding our way towards awakening. So virya, the third factor of awakening. And today I'd like to talk about it in terms of courage. Courage for all these small little things that we often need and that we are building with our meditation practice. So thank you. So now I'd like to open it up if there are any questions. And if, it looks like I lost the what's happening on YouTube. Maybe I can find it again. Otherwise, I was going to ask if some people on YouTube had questions. But are there any questions here in the room? Oh, yes.
Anne. I loved your mouse poem. Who is that by and what was it entitled?
Yeah, so the poet is Rosemary Traumer, and she spells her first name like Rose Mary, like Merry Christmas. And her last name is Traumer, Traumer. And the name of the poem is Mus Musculus, which is the Latin name for mouse. And if you just type in M-U-S, that's the first word, you'll find it.
Thank you.
Yeah, she's a practitioner. She's a Buddhist practitioner. And she publishes a poem every day on the internet. So I find myself using her poems a lot. And I think they're fantastic. So anybody else have a comment or question?
Thank you. That was, for me, very timely. And your connection between courage and trust. In fact, even the mouse story, I wanted to share an anecdote from my own life, which is when my daughter was very young. She might have been a year old. She would say to me, "Dad, please come sleep with me because there's a monster in my room." So, you know, I'd go and, you know, sleep and try to get her to bed. And she, you know, she'd immediately fall asleep, right? That trust of having Dad in right next to you. And one evening, in fact, as I was sitting, I would normally just read. And, you know, after a little while, after she'd fallen asleep, I started to hear a scratching sound. And I said, "Oh, my God, there really is a monster." And it turned out to be a squirrel in the attic. This is when we lived in Ithaca, New York. There was a squirrel in the attic, and so it all kind of came together for me. And even a little bit of the turning fear into compassion, right? We tried to figure out why it was the squirrel. And it turned out she'd had a little nest up in her attic, and so the squirrel herself was trying to get to, you know, her own little brood, and so we're trying to figure out, you know, how do you
take care of the squirrels
so,
and your daughter and the daughter and your house.
Yeah, so anyway, so it really sort of resonated for me, because after that, you know, my daughter was like, you know, with Dad in the bed, she didn't even hear the mouse, right? Or the squirrel. It sort of had transferred on to me to sort of. So anyway, that to me makes a lot of sense, because we often just want to kind of have Dad or somebody else come in and get the squirrel out of the, you know, figure out that it's a squirrel and get it out of our attic. And then, you know, you let it go, right? It's not unlike a gnarling thought in your head that once you identify it, you can let the squirrel go. And anyway, so that was what came to mind.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that story. And you know what? I lost YouTube on here. It's a little bit too complicated for me to get it back up. It's now I have a Gil Fronstahl's giving a Dharma talk on my YouTube here. So that's surprising. Okay. So thank you all. And I wish you a wonderful week. I'll stay up here if anybody has any questions. Thank you.